Hi, I'm Micah. I'm an alcoholic. I'm pretty nervous about being here. I just looked at my watch that has my heart rate, and normally it's at like 81, and right now it's at 141. So just bear with me a little bit. I love Austin Recovery. This place has just been amazing, and I love it so much that I came here twice. But by the grace of God and the love in these rooms, I've been sober since July 15th of 2012. And so a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I grew up in Corpus Christi, and I came from a really, really large family. My dad had 7 sisters and 2 brothers, and I had tons of cousins. And when we all got together, there was like 100 of us at all of our outings. And at about 3 or 4 years old, one of my older cousins started molesting me. And I didn't understand why somebody that loved me, like why I felt bad about the way somebody was loving me, because I knew he was family, and I knew that the way that I felt about it must be wrong. And so I learned at a really, really young age not to trust my feelings. And then when I was about 12 years old, I finally came out and I told my mom. And it came out that he had been molesting a couple other girls my age, and his mom was going through like a mental breakdown kind of thing. So all the moms got together and decided not to say anything. And so then I realized that even though I couldn't trust my feelings, they weren't important. So at 12 was when I started drinking. I remember the first time that I drank, I felt finally pretty enough and smart enough and funny enough, and I knew that I was going to do it again and as much as I could. And so I starting at 12, my parents weren't big drinkers, but they drank so little that we could like steal alcohol and replace it with water and they didn't notice. So, like, we kind of got by on that. And then at 16, at 15, I got kicked out of driver's ed for showing up drunk with a girlfriend of mine. And then they made me wait for, like, 6 months to take it again. And then, so it didn't start off good, me and driving and drinking. And at 16, I went out with a girlfriend of mine, and we went with 2 of our friends who date raped us, essentially. And I wasn't going to tell anyone because I already knew that it didn't matter from the way that my mom had reacted the first time. And I knew that her reaction was to get angry out of fear, but I didn't know it was fear. So I wasn't going to say anything. And then some friends of mine that I told on the phone that night while I was crying showed up at my house at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and they said, "Micah, go wake up your mom. The cops are on their way." And so I had to wake up my mom from a dead sleep and tell her that the police were coming and why. And she did not handle it well. And she didn't know how to handle it. And she grew up in an alcoholic home. She didn't ever drink, but she's an alcoholic without the alcohol. And that's how she was taught. She's a very loving person, but she's an alcoholic. She's one of us. And her reaction to me was along the lines of, like, look what you did to our family. And so when we got to the hospital, I was crying, getting the rape kit. And this was, I'm 35 now. This was when I was 16. It's a long time ago. And it was treated a little bit differently. And so the nurse told me to She told me to shut up and stop crying because it was my fault anyways. I was there for... And so, for some reason, I went a couple weeks later to talk to the detectives by myself in a room, and there were 2 men, and they told me, "Well, we've already talked to these boys, and we know that, you were asking for it." And, they said if I went to court that all of these terrible things would come out about me and my mom would be there to see them. And so I didn't. So the people that I was supposed to be able to trust, I found out I couldn't. And so that's where my life really kind of took more of a downward spiral into drugs. I started using cocaine at 16. I was already drinking alcoholically. And I, you know, I managed to get by. I graduated high school. I went to college. And the only reason I wanted to get out of the house to go to college was so that I could be out from under my mom's thumb and drink as much as I wanted to. And I did. And my first year in college, I was at Texas A&M University, and bonfire fell. And it killed one of my friends. And it was somebody that I had traded shifts with so that I could, you know, study. And I took a lot of that guilt with me. That's my daughter. I took a lot of that guilt with me, and I dropped out of school so that I could just be drunk and high all of the time. And then it became more of a situation of, like, you know, waking up in the morning with that darkness and that despair and that self-loathing of, I can't believe I did that, or what did I do, and not knowing. The worst, I think, is when somebody else relates back to you what you've done because you can't remember. And so then it became, you know, the constant use to try to obliterate the memories from constant use. I did a lot of of drinking and drugging and men, and none of them made me happy, and I hated myself, and I tried to pretend like I hated you instead. And so then I tried to move because I thought, well, it's just this situation in this town, and there's nothing to do here but drink, and I've gotten into all of these bad drugs, and if I move cities, then I'll be fine. So I got up, and I moved to Austin, just loaded up my car with my meth-smoking buddy, and thought, like, very efficiently. And so I decided that coming to Austin was the thing to do, and we were going to get sober, and we were going to not get high here anymore. So we found a place, and we found stuff, and I thought, if I wasn't doing meth and only drinking, then... sorry, my daughter's wiping. If I wasn't doing meth anymore and I was only drinking, then that meant I didn't have a problem because I was able to quit. And I didn't know anything about AA. Like I said, my grandparents were alcoholics, and my mom grew up in an alcoholic home, and her sister and her brother are both alcoholics. But she tried to shield us from all of that, and so I knew nothing about alcoholism. Her brother is sober, her sister is not, and her parents got sober through religion. So AA was foreign to me, but even if I had known what it was, I doubt I would have come. One of the things about my drinking career was that I was a blackout drinker, and I drank all day long and then would blackout and then find receipts from places I had driven, have horrible messages on my phone. I like to call my mom in blackouts, apparently, so she started turning her phone off at night. And I'm not a nice blackout drinker. I see some people, like, you know, like some people at bars that get all drunk and happy, and that's not me. Like, I would freak out and start fights and hurt myself, try to hurt other people. It was just awful. And I never really understood what that was about. And I started researching it not too long ago. And this is kind of off topic, but really interesting to me. The Journal of Neuroscience has done some studies on what they think blackouts are. And they think that, like, we're not creating new memories. Like, the synapse is dulled, so you can't create any short-term memories. And so you're reacting off of exactly what you think happened, but not what happened. So you're just creating this, like, crazy, like, you know, I was the person that started a two-hour fight because you changed the radio station. And it was just ugly. I went to jail a lot. I had MIPs and PIs and DWIs. And I was very fortunate that College Station had a system of handwritten folders. They didn't have a computer system at the time. And so every time I went in, they asked me if it was my first offense, and I said yes. And they said, well, then here's a deferred adjudication. And then I would wait out my deferred adjudication, and then it would be gone. And I probably went through the system like that, like 6 or 8 times. So when I got to Austin, I still didn't think there was anything wrong with my drinking. And I drank a lot. And my favorite thing was to get like a bottle of liquor and a 12-pack of Cokes and sit down and watch that show Intervention. And then... and I would watch it and I would get really, really drunk and I would think, how sad that those people have that problem. And it's awful. I can't watch that show anymore. It's it's hard. So one night I got really, really drunk and I called my dad. My mom's phone was off. So I called my dad, and my dad is, he needs anger management classes for sure. And he was having, it was like 6 o'clock in the morning. I'd been drinking all through the night. I hadn't gone to sleep. And I called my dad, and he got really crazy mad and yelled at me and was talking about how he was going to commit suicide. And I said something along the lines of, well, you and I are so much alike. If you say you're going to kill yourself, then that's like me saying I'm going to kill myself. And I don't know what he actually said, but what I heard was, go ahead. And now I know my dad. And my dad would never say that, but that's what I heard. So I got off the phone with him, and I called this 800 number that I had put in my phone like a week before for like a mental health thing. With no intention of calling it. And I called this number, and they got all of my information. And I told them this story. And then they said, hang on, we're going to transfer you. And they transferred me to PES, which is Psychiatric Emergency Services. And the lady said, well, we were told you were going to kill yourself. And I said, no, that's not. And she goes, well, you have to come up here. And I said, I can't. I'm drunk. And they said, well, if you're not here within the hour, we're going to send an ambulance. And then I thought, oh, shit. I already gave them my address and everything while I was on the phone. So I had to call my cousin to come pick me up and drop me off downtown at PES. And I sat there so long, going from this person to that person and waiting, that I started to get hungover because I'd been up there forever. And they told me, for the first time in my life, I was honest with somebody. And I don't know why, but I was honest with somebody about how much I drank and how often. And they said, we have a bed for you at Austin Recovery. And I said, I don't need that. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. And they said, well, we really think you should go to treatment. And I said, no, I'm going to go call my mom. So I called my mom, and her phone was still off. And... So then I called my little brother, and I was crying, and I said, Adam, they want me to go to a treatment center. And I was expecting him to be flabbergasted. And he said, oh, thank God. And I hung up the phone with them, and I went back inside, and I said, okay. So they told me to wait some more, and I called my cousin and told him I was done, and I went home. And I crawled into bed and put the covers over my head, and there was a knock at my front door, and I didn't get up to answer it, and my cousin had not left, so he answered it. And two people from PES walked into my house, and they walked into my room, and they sat down on my floor. And no matter how many times I told them to go away, they wouldn't. And they talked to me about Austin Recovery and about what being sober could do. And so I verbally agreed to go to Austin Recovery. And then they left. And later that day, I got online because I knew nothing about recovery. And in my mind, I thought that that rehab was like a building with like lots of like dealers lining the streets just waiting for you to like walk by. And I was terrified. I had no idea what it was. And so I got online and I started looking, and I looked up the schedule, and there was yoga like on Wednesdays or something, and I thought, I hate yoga. I'm not going. I'm not going to go to Austin Recovery. So I went back and forth all day, and I called Austin Recovery about an hour before I was supposed to be there the next day, and I said, I can't make it. I said, I'm scared, and I can't get there. And they got back on the phone with me, and they said, you have 24 hours. We'll give you a hold. And I ended up coming, and it was surreal. It changed my life. That was back in 2009, and it was my first introduction into AA or sobriety of any kind, and I just found a lot of love and a lot of kindness and a God that I was afraid of. And I didn't know really how to deal with that. And I had somebody, you know, I grew up in most of my family was Catholic, and it was one of those kind of things, like, if you think it, you may as well have done it, and you're all going to hell. And I was terrified of that God, and I didn't want to talk to that God. I didn't want to tell him the bad things I'd done because, you know, he was going to strike me down. And I talked to a girl in Austin Recovery. She was coming in, bringing a meeting, and she said, well, do you believe that God created you as a human? And I said, yes. And she goes, well, then why would he be mad at you for being human? And it was a big aha moment for me of, like, he did create me this way. And the things that I've done, I do have free will, but he still knows, right? He knows I'm going to do them, and he's there to forgive me for them. And so I was able to begin a relationship with God like I've never had before. And, you know, in the Bible, and you don't have to believe in Jesus, but it's the same either way. In the Bible, it talks about the faith of a mustard seed, which is the tiniest seed, and it grows into a huge tree. And that's all you have to have, right? You just have to have that little bit of, and it doesn't even have to be faith. It can be doubt, a little bit of doubt that maybe there is a God, right? And that's all it takes. And God has grown my relationship with him in amazing ways. And I got sober. I was one of those people that I got sober, and my life immediately was better. I hadn't done a whole lot of crazy damage that I had to rectify. And, you know, I still had my apartment, still had a car, you know, thanks to my parents. But I did have all of that when I got out of treatment. And I don't suggest this if there are clients here, but I met a guy while I was in treatment who was also in treatment. So on the outside, he and I started dating. So back in 2009, on Sundays, the women would serve sandwiches through the line because it was the day that the kitchen staff got off. And my now husband came through, neck tattoos and everything, dragging his feet because he was in detox. And he said, you sure make a mean sandwich. And I said, I didn't make it. And he said, will you serve a mean sandwich? So about 2 weeks later, while I was at an outside meeting, I had graduated out, and he had gotten shipped in. He was standing behind me in the coffee line. He said, I know you from somewhere. And just real shitty. I was like, probably AA. Like, it's the only thing that I could think of where I'd been. But he didn't hold that against me. So So we started dating, and 9 months into sobriety, I found out I was pregnant with my first child. And it was scary and also awesome. And so at 18 months sober, I gave birth, and immediately my child and my boyfriend at the time became my higher power. And I didn't have time to go to meetings. I had a baby in the house, and I had pretty bad postpartum, and I didn't want to do anything. And part of that postpartum was that I'd quit going to any type of AA or practicing any type of AA several months beforehand. I had all of the excuses, you know, and they made sense to me. And so at about 2.5 years sober, I went to my best friend, Gina, and I said, it was after a speaker meeting, I think, at Northland. And I said, if things don't change, I'm going to kill myself. And so then I went into Austin Lakes. And I was not happy about it. I was, they hold you there. You can't leave. You can check yourself in, but you can't check yourself out. And I was stuck there for about a week and maybe 5 days with a small baby at home. And I struggled with it. And then when I got out, I started doing AA again, really, really vigorously, and going to meetings every day. And my life got better. It's weird how it happens. And so then, you know, I fell off from that again because that's what I'm really good at doing. And then I started to entertain thoughts of like, well, once Maddie's 18 and out of the house, then I can drink all I want because she's not going to depend on me. And those were the thoughts that I started playing over and over in my head. And I started to give them power. And then when my husband told me, I went to him and I said, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. And he said, I don't think I'm an alcoholic either. I'm just a drug addict. And I said, all right. And so we went to dinner and we ordered a drink. And it seemed like the most logical thing to do. In the Big Book on page 40, when recounting a slip with Bill and Bob, Fred says, I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink, but I was confident it could not happen to me after what I had learned. He goes on later to say, not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time, I had not thought of the consequences at all. So it's not about information, it's about transformation, right? So I had all the information, and I still took that drink, and then I took another, and then I got cut off. And then we went to the liquor store. I bought stuff to make drinks, got so drunk I threw up, and then the next morning I convinced myself that it wasn't because I overdrank, but because I hadn't drank in a long time, my body wasn't used to it. So I convinced myself, you know, it also talks in the book about no longer able to differentiate the true from the false. And so when I had gotten sober, I had surrounded myself with a bunch of really, really strong AA people. They had become my family, and they had seen me through a lot of stuff. And I convinced myself that they didn't really like me. They didn't really care about me, and I didn't really need to be around them. And so my husband and I decided that even though we had a child in the house, we were going to start drinking. And then we were going to smoke crack, but only in the bedroom after she'd gone to sleep. And so we did. And we were like, that wasn't that great. So then like a couple days later, we went and got like an 8-ball or something and did that. And it wasn't that great. And so then we got super drunk one night, and I think I passed out. I blacked out, at least. One of those walking blackouts where, you know, you wake up and your skin is still drunk. And I woke up to a needle in my arm and my husband for the very first time at 30 years old. And my husband telling me, this will wake you up. And it did. And so after that, we started doing meth with our baby in the house. She was 18 months old, and I was about a week shy of my 3 years. And it took about 3 months for all the shit to come falling down. In that time, we decided that the best thing or the smartest thing for us to do, since we couldn't afford to keep getting high, was to move the dope dealer into our house so that he could pay us in rent and dope. There were nights that I was so scared of the rival dope dealer who would come into our cul-de-sac. I would line up glasses and bottles on my daughter's windowsill so that if he came through her window, I would hear them crash. I have a lot of... I have a lot of hard feelings around the way that I that I handled that. And in my addiction, my thought was, well, I'm only smoking it in the garage when she's awake, and I'm waiting for her to go to bed before I shoot up. And that was how I told myself that it wasn't as bad as it could be. And so about 3 months in, there was a knock on the front door, and I opened the door, and it was the police. And they said, where is, I don't want to say the name, but the dope dealer, where is he? And I said, I don't know. And they pushed themselves in the house. And I screamed out, the cops are here. And they came in, and they took us all out of the house. And they put me in the back of a cop car with my 18-month-old. She was 20 months at the time, 21 months. And I sat in the back of the cop car and waited for CPS to come and take her while I watched my husband being handcuffed in front of me. And I called some of my friends, and I said, I need your help. And they all showed up. And I called my mom, and I said, Mom, I need you to come in from Houston, and I need you to get Maddie. And she said, why? And I said, I'm getting arrested. And she said, why? And I said, because we had a lot of meth in the house. And luckily the police took the phone before she could say too much to me at that point. But I sat in the back of their car, and I watched all of these things unfolding. And I remember a huge sense of relief because it was over, one way or the other. Some of my, all of our friends showed up. One of the ladies immediately got certified to take Maddie, so she never touched CPS's hands. And she got to go with a family friend that she knew, and then my mom came in and got her. I'm really, really fortunate for that. We all went to jail. And about 36 hours into the holding, they called my name, and I went to the desk, and they said, you're being released without charges. And I said, why? And they said, you'll have to talk to the detective about that. And so I talked to the detective, and he told me that all of my friends that had shown up had vouched for me and said that I had had this thing and it was a recent slip and that they really thought I could get it again. And he said, I didn't want to mess your life up with giving you a felony. He said, I'm going to give you a shot. So my husband he was looking at a 3 strikes and you're out lifetime rule. And he was looking at life in prison. And I talked to that detective. And my husband has a number of felonies. And I talked to that detective and I said, listen, I don't have the money to bail him out, but I do have us both a bed in Austin Recovery. And I said, can you help me out? And so he contacted the judge and they released him on a PR bond, which is not normal. So we both came up here to Austin Recovery again. Let me tell you about my delusion. I came into Austin Recovery after all of that, and my thought was that I didn't have a problem, but that Brian was such a bad alcoholic and addict that he couldn't use anymore, and I was going to come to Austin Recovery to support him. And I believed it. I believed it wholeheartedly. So I got here. And the first week I was here, they had the outside meeting. And you can't go unless you've been here for like a week or something, if I recall correctly. Or that's how they did it then. And so there was me and two other girls, and then a lady that brought in a meeting. And when she found out that one of the girls was a first-time AA person, she changed her topic over to the first step. And I thought, well, I know a lot about this, right? So I was going to give my two cents. And so I said, yeah, like, listen to how powerless I was. And I said, I would lay on the bed while the dope dealer held my arm out straight. And the other person, my husband, would shoot me up. And I would have a pillow over my face saying, no, 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 the whole time. And the way that I was telling it from my side was, look what they did to me. And the way she heard it, she clapped her hands and she said, now that's powerless. And it hit me that I was completely powerless. That I put myself in that situation, and as much as I wanted it and didn't want it, I was still doing it. And thankfully that woman was there, right? I don't know how long it would have taken me. So fast forward like a month, we're out of treatment and everything's going great. And we've moved into this like tiny one bedroom apartment. We're working our asses off at jobs where like we're just underappreciated, but we have jobs and we're out. And my mom has my daughter and we're driving to Houston every weekend to see her for 2 hours. And she won't let Brian see Maddie, cause she's angry at him. And the courts have decided not to force the issue. So Brian's driving me to Houston, and he's sitting outside my mom's apartment for 2 hours while I hang out with Maddie. And then Maddie's screaming and crying when I have to go. And then we're crying the whole way home. Somehow in all of that, like, we were happy because we were free. We really dug into the work. We worked really, really hard doing AA and, you know, at our jobs and doing anything that we could. There was about 45 days during the Christmas season that we were in a 650-square-foot apartment. So we worked with CPS. We did everything. We had to call them. They wouldn't give us things to do because we had done so much. So we would say, what next? And they'd say, we have to get back to you. And we would say, that's not good enough. And we would have to keep calling over and over. And we did. We just kept on them until they gave us the things that we needed. And we ended up getting Maddie back 6 months after she was placed with my mom instead of a year. They closed our case. But it wasn't easy. They wouldn't give us. We had to go to the higher-ups all the time. Like, our caseworker was just overloaded, and so we had to go to her higher-up and then to that person's higher-up, and we ended up doing it, and we got it done. And so it is doable for any moms in here. Just keep at it, because it's totally worth it. We did a lot of – oh, this is the worst part. I kind of skipped over. We did a lot of hair samples. The reason that – or while I was in Austin recovery I got word that my not quite 2-year-old had had a hair follicle test and tested positive for meth in her system. And I felt like a piece of shit. And all of those things that I thought about myself, about being a bad mom and being a horrible person and not deserving any happiness, all of that became true because then it was on paper. So I came out of the counselor's office and I walked into a meeting, and the lady that was chairing said, do you want to share? And I didn't, but I opened my mouth and I shared it anyways. And I knew all those moms in there were going to look at me like the piece of shit that I knew I was. And instead, they loved me. And that was my first experience with having some burden carried for me. And it was a little bit lighter when I walked out of there because those women helped me. They helped me hold it. And I'm a huge proponent of opening your mouth, even in the worst, what you think is the worst. So anyways, that 650-square-foot apartment, we ended up with Brian, myself, and Maddie. And then my dad needed some work, and I had a place that he could come up and work, and it took about 45 days. So my dad and my little brother came up, and we had 3 dogs in the apartment, a cat, and we were taking pieces of, like, foam from memory foam and stuff and like laying it in the floors like so everybody could sleep. And my dad also, he's an AC guy, had all of his equipment in my apartment because I didn't have a garage. And it was insanity. There was nowhere to move. And it was one of the best months of my life. I was so happy. I was so happy to be free. So we stayed sober. That was back in, 2012. And Brian got a really, really good job that by all means on paper he should not have. And we were able to move into a rental house out of that apartment. And after about 2 years of sobriety, we got married on the beach. We were surrounded by friends and family and loved ones and everything like that. We bought a new home, and then we bought a new car, and then we started buying all of the things. And my life was like a fairy tale. And after right around 3 years sober, I was walking through IKEA, and I had this feeling like, he's high. And I thought, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to wait for him to get home because he travels a lot. And I'm going to, go talk to him and look him in the eye and see what he says. And I realized I got to get my house in order. And that's really like God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, because I was able to go back to AA and get a strong foundation. And I didn't ever say anything to him. I said something to a couple of friends in front of him, like, oh, I thought he was high, but... And he never flinched. I did get my house in order. So I got really plugged back in. And about a month later, he came home, and he couldn't hide it anymore. And it was a really crappy day. And I was scared, and I felt like this bubble had burst. And I didn't know what to do. I was angry. And he was out. He wasn't home. But I told him, I already know, so you may as well come home. And I went and I took a shower. And I played this playlist on my phone. It's called Serenity Now. And it's a bunch of Christian music. And it's and so I'm in the shower, and the song that I walk down the aisle to comes on. And it's that song, Oceans. I don't know how many of y'all know it, but there's a line in it, and it says... though my feet may fail and fear surrounds me, you've never failed and you won't start now. And I just had this grace wash over me. And so when he came home, I was able to meet him with love and with kindness and with understanding, and just let him make it. And so then after his relapse, I spent like the next 6 months playing the actor, and... struggling with watching him not do anything right. And I wanted him to do his stuff. I wanted him to get sober the way that I was sober, because I obviously knew what I was doing. and so luckily I have a really awesome sponsor that helped me. And so he did relapse again. And it was pretty minor that time. But again, a little more grace, because God and AA are prevalent in my life today, and I was able to do that, share that with him. And then, on a side note, not to talk about anybody, like, he's got it now, and it's pretty awesome to see. He is giving proper, power to the severity and the insidiousness of this disease, and I'm watching him take those steps, and it's beautiful. It's really wonderful to see. Working the steps today, just, it makes me free of all of that. I still get fear, and I still get anger, and I still get all those things, but I have these tools, and I know how to let things go the way that I didn't before. I know how to let God kind of take that. I don't blame my childhood anymore for my actions. I spent a long time doing that. And I think it's really understandable for women that have gone through that type of thing. But I've found freedom from that. My child she's happy, and she's healthy, and she's safe. She pulled through like a champ, and kids are really resilient, thankfully, but She's just a huge blessing in my life. I have a really good marriage now, and better self-esteem than I've ever had. I can look myself in the mirror, and that's pretty special. My relationship with like my parents and my brothers is a lot stronger than it was. And I'm just, you know, I think the big thing is I'm no longer cloaked in shame. And I feel like I was for a really long time. On page 124 of the big book, it says, "We grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. This painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problem. We think each family who has been relieved owes something to those who have not. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them." I think that's a really strong point that, you know, as long as we carry this message, then our dark past is actually an asset to us. The minute that we don't, the minute that we try to keep it or that we stop carrying it, it becomes baggage. And then for me, that baggage is heavy, you know. It doesn't take me long to get weighed down. The upside is that God honors effort. That's what my husband likes to say. you know, he blesses me more and more each day, and all I have to do is ask. And I heard one time, and I love it. It says, "My cup runneth over," and then I ask God for a bigger cup, and he gives me that too. Thanks.